Tragedy strikes and a flood of heart-wrenching news stories follows. This hour, we'll talk about the importance of bearing witness and the challenge of telling these stories.
We have a whole sort of routine. And I mean, what a terrible thing to have a routine about. How to respond to a dozen or more people killed in one fell swoop for no good reason.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. I'll talk with NPR's Sarah McCammon, who's covered two mass shootings in just the last 6 months. I'll talk with two people who bear witness to heartbreaking stories every day. One, a trauma surgeon. Another, who works in crisis intervention. Then we'll talk about how a barrage of bad news affects all of us personally with a therapist, and how it affects policy decisions with a political scientist. We'd love to hear your thoughts as well. Join the conversation after the news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We've all had this moment. Tragedy strikes and we find out about it. Maybe it's on the radio or the television. Maybe it's through social media or a text from a loved one. What comes next? A flood of news, heart-wrenching stories, heated debate. It's often overwhelming. This hour, we're going to talk about bearing witness. What is the value of paying attention, even when the news is heartbreaking? We'll also talk about how to take care of yourself when it gets to be too much. To start the hour, a woman who helps news consumers bear witness. Sarah McCammon is a reporter for NPR, and in the past 6 months, she's covered two mass shootings. She went to Las Vegas last October in the aftermath of the massacre that left 58 people dead and 851 injured at the Route 91 Harvest Music Festival. And just a few days ago, she traveled to Parkland, Florida to cover the shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School that left 17 people dead. And she is with me now. Hello, Sarah.
Hi, Charity.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us. And as you headed out to cover the Parkland shooting, you tweeted, "Just boarded a flight to go cover a mass shooting for the second time in less than 5 months. And of course, there have been so many others in between. And on a day that's about celebrating love and for Christians, a holy day." I would love to know, as you broke down your feelings that moment into enough characters to fit into a tweet, what else was going through your head? What were you thinking about?
Well, like I said, I mean, I was thinking about how commonplace this is and how, I mean, just sort of how morbidly mundane it's become. Never mundane when someone's life is lost, but we're used to it. We have a whole sort of routine. And I mean, what a terrible thing to have a routine about, how to respond to, you know, a dozen or more people killed in one fell swoop for no good reason. So, I was getting on the plane. I was thinking about Las Vegas, which was the last shooting I had covered. And I should say this is at least the fourth mass shooting I've covered as a journalist, and a lot of journalists have covered many more. I also covered the Charleston shooting that took the lives of 9 people at a historically black church in 2015. And when I was a young reporter in Nebraska, I was involved in covering the Von Maur shooting at a shopping mall in Omaha. And as I say, you know, many other reporters have covered many more. There was a reporter in Florida who tweeted that she's just, I think, 23 or 24 years old. She was interviewed on NPR. It's already her third. So it's getting ridiculous. It's heartbreaking. It's tragic. And it just keeps happening. And you know, I think as a reporter, obviously, we don't take positions on policy. But I think as a human, you're allowed to say this is ridiculous. This should not be happening.
Now, as a reporter, of course, it's your job to tell the public what's going on. And you mentioned how common this has become. So it's also your job to get people to really pay attention, to connect with the information, to really understand what's going on. How do you approach that? How do you do that?
I think it's definitely a team effort. And every time we cover one of these, we have a team of people on the ground. You know, first of all, just sort of the first line is just trying to update listeners on what's happening, the basics, you know, journalism, who, what, when, where, why, the why being probably the hardest part. to understand. But how many people are affected? Where did this happen? Who did it? What do we know about how they got the weapon? That's kind of the first wave. And then it quickly turns into listening to the voices of the victims and survivors. And, you know, I think we've all heard some incredibly heartbreaking voices in the past several days, as we heard back in October, as we've heard so many times, from families who are just going about their day like any of us, having a normal day, thinking about, as one mom told one of my colleagues, you know, her biggest worry last week was her children learning how to drive, her teenagers learning how to drive. Suddenly, there's just a whole completely different perspective on what is scary and what is important and what is dangerous. And, you know, so we pretty quickly move into remembering the victims and hearing the voices of the people who are affected. And again, you know, every time they're completely heartbreaking.
Well, and every time they are completely heartbreaking, as you are telling these personal stories, getting close to the people who've been hurt by a tragedy, whether they've lost a loved one or whatever happened to them, how does that affect you personally?
Well, I'll get to that. But first, I want to say that it's tricky. And I, actually, there's a I don't have his name in front of me, but there was a reporter from the Parkland area who was interviewed about this question, or I think he wrote a piece, I believe it was for The Guardian, about sort of the ethical quandary sometimes of talking to people in these crisis situations. I believe he had a son who was at the shooting, may have been injured. But anyway, he was a local, and so he was being affected personally, but also was writing about this as a journalist. And you know, you're going up to people who are in trauma, who are, you know, reeling, they're in shock. And there's a delicate balance there between respecting their privacy and their wishes and their space and, you know, getting consent to interview them at a time when they may not be fully, you know, themselves. And also needing to tell their stories, needing to bear witness, as you say, and let the larger public know what is going on and what the reality of the situation in our country is. So that is something I think hard about. And I always approach people pretty gingerly, pretty delicately, and, you know, ask them if they'd be willing to talk and try to be as empathetic and you know, open as possible. And you get a lot of no's in situations like this. I mean, even just this last week, I was going around talking to just people in the Parkland area, many of whom, you know, had no direct connection to the shooting, but a lot of people said, no, thank you. I just can't right now. I just don't want to, because, you know, when something like this happens in your backyard, it's completely stunning. And it's, again, all too commonplace. But I think when it actually does come to a community, people are shocked and they're grieving, even if they didn't personally know anyone, because that sense of safety and that sense of, you know, knowing kind of what your community is suddenly really shattered. So it's hard to see that. It's hard to watch people going through that. There's a tension again between sort of doing my job and wanting to respect people who are going through, you know, possibly the hardest thing they've ever gone through in their entire lives. And then, you know, you're human, and so it does affect you. I remember doing an interview with a psychologist last time after Vegas. Just about the, you know, the psychological impact of these events on all kinds of people. And after, you know, as we were winding down our conversation, she said, "Look, are you okay?" And I said, "Oh, I'm fine. You know, I'm here. I'm staying in a hotel. I'm, you know, completely okay. I'm talking to people who have just been through this terrible trauma. Like, you know, don't worry about me, basically, because, like, why would I want? It just, it feels almost selfish and navel-gazing to talk about how you're doing." But she said, "No, look, you know, emergency responders, journalists, people who deal with this up close, and even the public to a large extent anymore, because everything is in our faces 24/7. There's a trauma there, and I think it's important for everybody to recognize that this kind of thing should not happen, and it does happen, and it can have a real impact on anybody who's affected by it. And the closer you are, I think probably sometimes the more, of course, the more intense that is."
You are involved in telling these stories, in making sure that they reach the public. Why do you feel that's so important? Obviously, there has to be something that keeps you going through this incredibly difficult task.
Right. Well, as I alluded to before, I mean, I think it's just important to get beyond the numbers and even the names, and to really, you know, put voices and faces and real life stories with what's happening. We can get really numb to this because it happens so much. And I think that would be, I mean, obviously we all have to take care of ourselves, and you can only focus on these things so much at one time, and everybody's in a different situation as far as what their capacity and their bandwidth is. But I think, you know, if we don't talk about it, if we don't hear from the families who've lost their children, if we don't hear from the survivors who witnessed these crimes, we won't fully understand what is really going on. And I think, you know, unfortunately, it takes sometimes a really traumatic event, or many of them, for some kind of change to happen. Obviously, we as a society don't agree about what that change should be. But I think we're starting to slowly hear more and more, at least lip service, maybe more, to the idea that something needs to change, that we need to put our heads together and do something. That, you know, what that is will remain to be seen. But I think telling those stories on the ground and really humanizing the people that are going through this, it's sort of the first step of that process, and giving voice to, you know, all these young students and survivors who are starting to speak out. You know, obviously we live in a day of social media, so social media gives them a voice, but really the mainstream media still has an important role to play in giving voice to people that wouldn't have a voice otherwise, and connecting, you know, Parkland, Florida with Las Vegas, Nevada, and all the other places around the country that have experienced this, and all the other cities that don't want to experience this, and, you know, sort of serve as a first step in connecting people and letting us as a society figure out, you know, what are we going to do about this? How are we going to move forward?
In addition to being a reporter, you are a mom and just a person. And just to return to what that psychologist asked you, I mean, when this gets to be a lot for you, and it has to sometimes, what do you do? How do you take care of yourself to keep going?
Yeah, this is something that I've talked with other reporters about in the last few months a couple of times, because reporters do deal with trauma and stress quite a bit. And self-care is a word we use a lot in these days, maybe use it too much, but it is important. It is, you know, as they say, you can't take care of other people if you don't take care of yourself. So I find myself in the days after Las Vegas, I came back, I went for a lot of hikes. I talked to people that I'm close to. This time I went to yoga as soon as I got back. You know, it's basic stuff. It's trying to get sleep, trying to, you know, maybe step away. And even while you're there on the scene, step away and get a meal with a colleague, or go for a swim or a run, or just whatever, you know, you can steal a few minutes of just peace and solitude. And I think that, you know, that's really important. It can feel a little selfish in the moment, but I think it's, again, none of us can help anybody else if we can't take care of ourselves first. And I would say that for everybody. I mean, I know that even as a civilian, not a journalist, if you're a parent, if you're a person, it is really hard to hear this stuff. And so I hope people are taking care of themselves and also thinking about, you know, whatever it may be that they can do. You know, maybe there's some kind of action they can take to try to prevent it. I've seen people doing all kinds of different things, and there are lots of different ideas out there. But I think there is a growing consensus that we have to put our heads together and figure out something.
Sarah McCammon, thank you so much.
Thank you. Good to be back on IPR.
Sarah McCammon is a reporter for NPR. In just the past 6 months, she's covered 2 mass shootings. We'll continue talking about bearing witness in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about bearing witness, how important it is, how difficult it is. Later on, we'll talk about self-care and caring for children during a time of tragedy. We'll also talk about the numbing effect and how that can affect us personally and affect policymakers as well. But while most of us watch tragic news stories from the sidelines, there are professionals who deal with tragedy and crisis every single day. Dr. Denville Myrie is a trauma critical care surgeon at Mercy Medical Center in Des Moines, a level 2 trauma facility and home of the busiest emergency room in the state. Hello, Dr. Myrie.
Yes, good morning, Charity. Yeah. Nice to be here.
Thank you so much for being here. And you, in your line of work, you witness trauma on a daily basis. What kind of an emotional toll does that take on you?
Well, I think it takes a significant toll on all of us that are involved in the care of the injured patient, particularly when you see young, healthy people present to your emergency department with devastating traumatic injuries. You know, we oftentimes have to basically put our own emotions on the sideline to deal with the emergency of saving a life. And there are times when we have very bad outcomes that we actually have a debriefing and just kind of go over things and give everybody who's involved an opportunity to decompress. But I mean, it's a significant toll, and with what's going on in our country today with these mass killings that has tripled in number since 2011, it's just devastating.
With people who come to work with you, who may be earlier in their career than you are, what kind of advice do you give them about how to cope? Because I can imagine that it can be very tough as you start this kind of work.
Yeah, I mean, it's extremely difficult. I think the advice I would give is to always think of what's in the best interest of your patient. And in the moment and time, you just have to compartmentalize and just put your emotions to the side and just deal with trying to save that life. And, you know, at the end of the day, if you know that you have done your best, I think you will be able to go on to the next day.
Do you worry about becoming desensitized to this kind of tragedy and violence because you encounter it every day?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's one of the, I mean, and I think our brain is structured and developed that way so that we can continue. I mean, if we do not compartmentalize a lot of these tragedies that we see, and unfortunately in doing that, you become, there's a process of desensitization, and it's unfortunate. But if you do not do that, you cannot go on. And the more that we see these tragedies is the more, not just the healthcare professional, but I think the nation as a whole is becoming desensitized. I mean, there are organizations out there that want us to become desensitized, that want us to think that mass killings and these tragedies is okay and is supposed to happen. It's not. It's really sad that we as a nation has more masculine and more gun-related violence than any other industrialized nation, 25 times the rate. I mean, what are we doing? Our children are being slaughtered in schools, in theaters, in parks, and our elected officials are sitting by and doing nothing. They're advocating that we should, in fact, introduce more guns in the schools. I mean, that idea is absolutely asinine. And I, as a trauma surgeon, a healthcare professional, I cannot imagine that the person who occupies the office of the presidency would advocate such a policy that would only increase the number of deaths and destruction that we see that's happening today.
Given your line of work, if there were a mass shooting in Iowa or in central Iowa, the patients would come to you and your staff. How do you prepare for something like that?
That is absolutely correct. There are two major trauma centers here in central Iowa, and we are one of them. And unfortunately, we're now conducting drills with our healthcare staff as to how to deal with a mass shooting or active shooter event. I mean, this is what this nation has become. children in schools are now have to be taught, go through drills, how to act in a mass casualty event. We do drills, and that's the only way that we're going to be prepared, because obviously the politicians aren't doing anything to curb the amount of guns in the street and to prevent these things from happening. So we have to be prepared for the eventuality when it happens. And it's not a matter of if it's going to happen again. It's only a matter of when and where. So we have drills, mass casualty drills and active shooter drills. And in fact, the American College of Surgeons, the American Association for the Surgery of Trauma, and the American Trauma Society and other healthcare organizations have all now implementing and introducing a campaign which is titled Stop the Bleed, because majority of people who die from gunshot wound die from hemorrhage. So we're empowering the community to render first aid in incidents of mass shooting or other major trauma that results in significant amount of hemorrhage. We're teaching average people how to intervene and how to stop somebody from dying from a gunshot wound or hemorrhaging to death,
which is already saving lives, as we know. I asked you earlier how you deal with the heartbreak and the sadness. How do you deal with the anger? Because it's clear that you are angry that this is happening.
I am, because you know, one of the tenets of medicine is first do no harm and do everything in your power to protect your patient from harm and injustice. And we are not doing that. We are, as a nation, we are not protecting our young people. We're not protecting our children. I mean, look at Sandy Hook. I mean, 28 innocent people, children, lost their lives. Now we just have another shooting in Parkland, Florida. Young, bright, energetic children who are looking forward to a future. Future leaders, future physicians, doctors, nurses, teachers, firemen, and as no fault of their own, they're gunned down in their own school. I mean, it is frustrating, and it saddens me to see that our politicians are doing nothing. And, you know, it's, as I said, the only way you can cope with this is basically just compartmentalize your emotions. I mean, when I'm in the trauma bay, nothing else is on my mind. All I am focused on is my patient and what am I going to do to save that patient's life. Afterwards, we have other things that we can do to decompress, but in the moment in time, that's all I'm concerned about.
A lot of us need hope to keep us going. Can you find hope in this situation?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think there are help out there. I mean, I have no qualms about if I need to, speak to a professional to help decompress. And as I said, we have, there are instances where we have, when we gather around after a really bad event and, we decompress and everybody goes through how they're feeling and their own emotions. But, you know, it's also, as a trauma surgeon, I have to talk to those parents and those loved ones and tell them that they're never going to see their loved ones again. And that is not easy. I mean, that is one of the most difficult part of my job. And I am doing this way too often.
Dr. Myrie, thank you so much for talking with me today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Denville Myrie is a trauma critical care surgeon at Mercy Medical Center in Des Moines, a level 2 trauma facility and home of the busiest emergency room in the state. With me now is Bo Pinkham. He deals with a different kind of trauma. He is the Crisis Intervention Services Director at the Crisis Center of Johnson County. Bo, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you've been involved in this work for about 16 years. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about the kinds of situations you encounter.
Yeah, and you know, it's been interesting because things have changed since I first started as a volunteer in 2002. back then it was just one crisis line, and it was generally social isolation, maybe people dealing with schizoaffective disorders, maybe hearing voices or whatnot, and then the usual 1-2 punch of depression and anxiety. As we've seen over the past, especially over the past decade or so, we've really done a better job of breaking down the stigma against suicide. So people have opened up about suicide quite more. With our online services especially, there's a psychological effect where people will just be more open about certain issues online. And so our rates of people talking about suicide online are just much more compared to phone lines in general. So we've been dealing with a lot more suicide in the past decade or so.
Given that you are helping people who are going through incredibly difficult situations, what kind of an emotional toll does that take on you?
Yeah, it's a weight that you carry. And it's always been interesting to me that it's the things you don't know that you carry with you more.
What do you mean?
It's the ambiguity. You know, if someone, you know, I don't know what their means are for suicide, and they haven't really agreed to a safety plan, but I don't have enough to say that I should get the police involved or whatnot, and I end the contact with them, that'll stay with me personally more than someone, you know, who I even know, you know, has a plan for suicide and maybe we've called the police on them, or especially someone who's made a safety plan for us. Even if they're at high risk, I know that we're going to be following up with them in the morning. So it's the things you don't know that are tougher. I don't think the human mind really likes ambiguity and not knowing anything. Or maybe that's just me because I'm a curious person. But I've always struggled with letting things go. And that's something that we have to teach our volunteers today, is just you're not going to get everything that you want out of this interaction because you don't lead this interaction. The client does.
Now, obviously, the people that come to work with you are motivated by love, by empathy, by the desire to really make a difference. What kinds of things do you talk to them about? Because this is a kind of work that can lead to a lot of burnout, a lot of emotional overload. And actually, you know, people who work in this kind of line of work often encounter depression themselves.
Yeah. It's always a struggle because it's a very personal thing to make sure that people have their own, you know, self-care plan. And self-care is a term that we throw out a lot, you know, and it's really kind of entered the national dialogue, which is good. But it's more than just, you know, watching Netflix or, you know, going out to your favorite restaurant. It's really intrinsically looking at, you know, what drives you, what gives you energy, and right now what's getting in the way of that, and how can you take various steps. It almost mirrors what we do with our clients. What are the steps you can take to feel better, to feel like you can go on? And especially for our volunteers, you know, we have 24-hour supervision, so they always have someone that they can talk to. They can always email their coordinators, me, the director. You know, we try to create a culture of opening up about these things, about what's really affected you from your contacts with the people that we talk to. And it's been a challenge because, you know, more and more, crisis services is very remote. You know, we have remote volunteers. We've had people volunteer from China and Belarus and whatnot when people were studying abroad. And we need to make sure that they know that they can send a quick email. They can, you know, call us, Skype us, whatever they need to do to reach out. You know, the good doctor was talking about how they have debriefing sessions. We have those too. You know, we have critical events at the crisis center as well. And sometimes we all have to just get together, see what worked, what didn't work, how everyone's feeling, how everyone's been affected, and then kind of make a plan for everybody going forward.
We actually started talking about doing this show during hurricane season, mm-hmm. because there were just so many heart-wrenching stories in the news, and it kept getting worse and getting harder every day. Clearly, a lot of people are feeling that after last week's shooting.
Sure.
And I wonder what you would say to people who are struggling, because it's hard to listen to the stories. It's hard to watch the stories, to look at the faces of children who were murdered. And yet looking, knowing these stories is important also. What would you say to people who are experiencing overload right now?
You know, weight is much easier born when it's spread out, right? So if you have any kind of person that you can interact with, and you don't have to throw everything on them. You don't even have to talk about what you're specifically dealing with, but just talking with someone and having them take the time to listen to you. They've started doing studies on just social isolation and how lethal that can be. You know, you can't do anything in a vacuum. So talking to people, forming a community, whatever that looks like for you, and really opening up about what's going on, or just talking about the weather, whatever makes you feel comfortable. That's first and foremost what I would tell people. You know, we like to think that everyone can get active, get involved, maybe start doing some grassroots campaigns, like really find what you love. Not everyone can do that, you know, and I don't like to think that that's the right step for everyone. But, you know, just being mindful, kind of using that mindfulness idea of where are these emotions coming from? What can I do about them? You know, what's my impetus for feeling this way? Just taking that to the forefront of your mind can really help people as well.
I find that as a news consumer, not only am I dealing with grief, mm-hmm. but then when I go on social media and I see the vitriol, the mm-hmm. anger, righteous or not, it's really stressful to see that, to experience that. I know a lot of people jump into that and maybe that's cathartic or helpful for them. But what would you say to people about that kind of just really hateful language that gets thrown around online?
Yeah. I mean, we tell our volunteers now and then to unplug. We tell ourselves to unplug. I've had trouble with it myself, you know. I mean, social media permeates everything we do these days. And, you know, it's very easy for me, a 35-year-old to be like, I just won't get on Facebook. For, you know, an 18-year-old volunteer, that's just not something they can do. That's their entire social life for the most part. So we tell them to unplug, or if need be, again, just be mindful of where do you think these person's thoughts are coming from? What's leading into that?
Because everybody use some empathy.
Yep.
We're out of time. Pinkham, thank you so much. Bo Pinkham of the Crisis Center of Johnson County. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about bearing witness, the challenges of bearing witness, the importance of bearing witness, the difficulty of telling these stories. And now we're going to focus on how these stories affect us and maybe how we take care of ourselves or how we channel that energy, our grief or anger into action. With me now is Michelle Hankins, a licensed mental health therapist at Humboldt County Memorial Hospital. Hello, Michelle.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for talking with me today. And we've talked so far this hour about the grief that people experience in the wake of a tragedy. We've talked about the anger that can come from that frustration. Let's talk a little bit more about how sometimes this kind of feeling of being overwhelmed, that kind of grief, can become more serious for people. I mean, this can be a very difficult thing to cope with for a lot of people, even if they weren't involved in the tragedy, right?
Correct. You know, we all tend to focus and deal with our fears and anxieties that we internalize when we hear of a traumatic event, or worse, if we're part of a traumatic event. We all deal with those in a very different manner. And in my work, I do a lot of work with children and teenagers and how they may work through a tragic situation, and even hearing about a tragic situation can be a whole lot different than you and I as adults would do.
Well, and with a tragic situation like the one last week with the shooting in Parkland, Florida, this is a situation that can cause a lot of anxiety and a lot of fear, because particularly for young people, when they see something like this happen, it's very easy for them to imagine it happening to them. And obviously there have been school shootings all over this country. They seem to be increasing with frequency. As a parent, how would you help a child deal with the anxiety that may come from that?
Right. I think the most important thing that we can do as parents and caregivers and professionals when we're working with our children and our youth is to be very honest with them. I mean, they are just like us. They have questions and they want answers. I think with kids, it's very important that we don't over-dramatize or fantasize a story with them. We're very honest and tell them the facts that, you know, as we know them, we let them know that, you know, there are people in this world, unfortunately, that make these types of choices and do put others in danger. But by being honest with them and then offering them reassurance and guidance as to the different safety measures that maybe have been, you know, in regards to the school shooting, safety measures that have been taken by their own school to protect them, or safety measures that, you know, you as a parent can build with your child or work through with them is very important. You know, we're going to see a lot of ways that kids can react to this, and, you know, some are going to obviously develop new fears, maybe some separation anxiety, especially in young kids. You know, if they hear about this, and you know, we all want to protect them and not tell them all these scary things that are happening in their world today, but unfortunately, they're going to hear about it in some way, shape, or form. And so then when they do, they may really start to have some of those anxieties that, you know, we're in Iowa, this happened in Florida, is it not going to happen to us, or could it happen to us? And as adults, we need to be realistic. This could happen anywhere. And so we need to be mindful of that and not necessarily prepare your child as to how to respond in a school shooting, but prepare them for the anxieties and the fears that come along with just those scary events that happen in the world.
Now, some kids are more prone to anxiety than others. Some kids really struggle with anxiety issues. And as parents, I mean, a lot of us have dealt with minor fears over the years, the fear of the dark, for example, and things like that. But when a fear is about something so much bigger and so real, I mean, at what point, what kind of signs do we look for to know that our kid may really need help dealing with the anxiety about this?
Well, I think, you know, kids can express their fears and anxieties in a lot of different manners. You know, you may see them start to become much more nervous or anxious when they maybe hear a siren, or maybe they, you know, something that they correlate to a traumatic event. You know, if that triggers them to think about those events, you know, you may see some more of that kind of on-edgeness or that nervousness from them. Some kids, you know, not necessarily with the triggers, but just overall struggle more with, you know, maybe isolating a little bit more, withdrawing a little bit more. Some have some real big sleep disturbances. You know, and some can just become really kind of, I mean, to the point where they appear almost angry or very irritable, you know, so it kind of can depend on the child, but I think we as parents and caregivers need to be very mindful of if a situation has happened and our child has been involved or has been privy to a piece of that. We need to really practice our patience at that point in time and focus in on how do we help them. And one thing that I think helps a child very much is being able to tell the story. So being able to, you know, talk through and just have us listen to them. You know, that is so important for the child to know that their feelings are okay, their voice is being heard. And we need to be real careful not to put our thoughts into their mind, but just let them speak and talk about how these events make them feel.
Do parents need to try to put their own anxiety aside? I think a lot of us feel fear about sending our kids to school.
Yes. You know, and I think to a point, but I also think we need to be human. You know, our children need to see we're telling them it's okay to share your feelings with me. I want you to have a voice. But then if we don't reciprocate and role model the same, we're kind of telling them the exact opposite. So I think it's very important that we share some of our realistic feelings with them, and we let them know that, you know, these traumatic things scare us just as well. But again, we have to remember that we're the adults and we're the parents, and we don't want to, you know, say, oh, I don't want you to go to school. I'm so scared about you going to school, because that's only going to increase their anxieties.
Right.
But if you share, you know, yes, this event scares me as well, and here's what we're doing to make sure that you're safe. You know, here's what we're doing to ensure that when I drop you off today, I'm going to be back to pick you up tonight. You know, but just be honest with them. Be very realistic.
Michelle, thank you so much for talking with me today.
You're welcome. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Michelle Hankins, a licensed mental health therapist at Humboldt County Memorial Hospital. And next we have with us Chris Larimer, associate professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. And he's done a lot of research about how people are affected by news events, how these news events affect policy makers. Chris, hello.
Hi, good morning, Charity.
And Chris, I was thinking about this just from a personal level. I remember exactly where I was and what I was doing when I heard about the massacre at Columbine High School. Mm-hmm. I remember where I was and what I was doing when I heard about Newtown. But there have been so many other events, truly tragic events, that didn't impact me in the same way, that I don't remember in, you know, it's not a life-defining moment like mm-hmm. those moments. I think I'm getting numb. What kind of effect does it have on people when they hear story after story after story?
Well, I think the concern here is with, you know, something called the psychic numbing effect, which actually goes back several decades. But a lot of this research is done by a researcher named Paul Slovic, who's out at the University of Oregon. And he's applied it to he's trying to answer the question of, you know, why do good people, in his words, ignore mass murder and genocide? And he's trying to get an understanding of how is it that we are getting numb to these types of things. And what he's finding is that people have, or at least are extraordinarily sensitive to numbers, particularly our perception of human suffering changes when the numbers change. And when I mean numbers, we're talking about the number of events or the number of individuals affected by a particular crisis. A lot of his work is on humanitarian crises, and he's done dozens of experiments looking at how do people evaluate the worth of providing aid to, say, a refugee camp where there are 250,000 refugees, and you can save 4,500 people versus a refugee camp of, say, 11,000 people, and you can save that same number, 4,500. People will evaluate those two situations very differently and will put more value on saving 4,500 lives in a smaller refugee camp. And what he's arguing is that people are very sensitive when it's a small group. And actually, in his own findings, it's down to a group of one. So you mentioned you remembered where you were with Columbine. I think a lot of people can remember, if they're old enough, back in the late 1980s, where they were when they heard about baby Jessica. And this is the example that Paul Slovic uses, baby Jessica McClure, who fell down in the well, mm-hmm. was eventually rescued. Right? People are very good at remembering.
The nation stopped. And
right, the nation
the
stopped,
thing.
Right? And that was what he calls an identifiable individual. There is one person there. And we are very affected by the power of an individual and an individual story. But once we get beyond the individual, and we have larger numbers or we have more frequent events, we start to become numb to those events and it doesn't have as big of an effect on us. And from a policy perspective, you know, that's where I've been doing some work with some colleagues where we're trying to understand when do policies actually change? Because in the past, we've talked about policy change can be the result of what scholars talk about as focusing events. And this goes back, again, a couple of decades to the work of John Kingdon, who says that, you know, where you see real significant policy change is when you have a policy window, that you have the policy stream, the political environment, and this problem all kind of coming together, and you see the opening of a window and you see big change. And what usually focuses the public's attention is a significant event or a focusing event. Well, you could argue that in the case of gun control, we've had several focusing events going all the way back to Columbine. Sadly, we've had dozens, but we haven't seen the big policy change that you would expect from that policy window's model. And I think you can relate it to some of the work that Professor Slovic has been doing on the psychic numbing effect, that it's no longer just an identifiable individual. It's becoming so common, sadly, and the numbers are increasing that it's getting attention, but it's not forcing the policy change that you would expect.
Well, another example of this would be how people have responded to the refugee crisis in Syria, which gone largely ignored. There was a focusing event that lasted for a while when there was a photo of a little boy who had drowned. And that effect lasted for a while, but I don't hear as much about, I mean, there was just another tragedy in Syria just this week. I don't hear nearly as much about it.
Yeah, and I think that's where Paul's work is particularly relevant, is when you're talking about that the refugee crisis, because that's where his work, he's really trying to work on it. And in fact, he's done a couple of experiments where he asks people to donate to save the children. And he presents a case where he donate to save the children. He presents the story of one child. In another case, people in the experiment are asked to, will they donate to save the children? They're presented the story of another child. But there's a third condition that he introduces where he asks people, are you willing to donate to save the children? And he presents the story of those two children simultaneously. And in that condition, donations actually go down. So what's happening is people are moved by an individual story. But once you get outside of the individual and get to a group of two or more, people, it doesn't have as big of an effect, right? So you're absolutely right. Over 300 people died by most reports in Ghouta in Syria this week due to bombings from the government over there. And we're seeing no effect. You mentioned the image of the boy who drowned when in trying to get away from some of this. There's the image of the boy on the ambulance in Syria after his home was bombed over a year ago. And you just don't see the attention to that issue anymore. And I think it goes back to Paul's work in terms of once the numbers get so large, adding, you know, another group of individuals doesn't seem to have the same effect as that initial story of one person.
So what's the lesson here? Now, I already talked to Sarah McCammon earlier about reporting on these things. And, you know, she's trying to share the stories in ways that people will understand, remember, connect. She's not trying to push a policy change, but what is the message for getting these stories to people?
Well, I think it's doing what Sarah has been trying to do in terms of talking about them in terms of individual stories, present those individual images of people who are directly affected by these crises. You know, in the past, when we've seen the big policy change, when there's been a focusing event, there's also been someone who's come out to be sort of a leader on the issue, someone you may not expect, an elected official or someone else who's very well known. It may be the case that regarding gun control, that in addition to these individual stories, if there is an elected official who comes out who maybe is unexpected that you wouldn't think would push for these, that can help that movement get a little bit more traction beyond just getting attention, beyond just getting congressional hearings to the point of actually seeing real policy change.
How does knowing all that you know about this change how you consume news after an event like this?
That's a good question. You know, I think it's watching for when you hear about about these events, I start to watch for, okay, you know, who are the significant actors? Is there movement? How are these events being covered? How are their individual stories being covered? I'm watching, you know, honestly looking through the papers, looking at what are the images that are associated with these events. How powerful are these images? How powerful are the individual stories? I think because that's where you're looking to see, okay, is this going to not only get attention from the public, but is it going to be sustained attention? And is it going to be to lead to action in state legislatures? Is it going to lead to action in Congress?
Do you think there's something different about this event?
I think right now there absolutely is something different in terms of you're seeing a significant mobilization of high school students, which we haven't necessarily seen in the past, where they're directly confronting elected officials. You know, for example, with Senator Marco Rubio last night, I think that's different right now. I think the question going forward is, how long does this keep our attention? What happens next, right? Because we've seen where we've had focusing events and they've led to more hearings, but we haven't seen the significant policy change. And so I think that's where we need to see if it's going to be different.
Chris, thank you so much for talking with me.
Of course. Thank you, Charity.
Chris Larimer, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. This hour, we've been talking about bearing witness, the challenges of bearing witness, the importance of bearing witness. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.